You can see my award-winning climate comedy show Spoilers at a festival near you, provided you live near or are going to McCunclith or Wells comedy festivals. More dates added soon near you, conceivably, who knows what might happen.
And if you are at Mac, come and see ComCom Redacted live at 4 p.m. on the Saturday.
Go to stuartgoldsmith.com and click the very attractive banner image to find out more.
This is a podcast from comedianscomedian.com.
This is the Comedian's Comedian Podcast. Hello and welcome to the show. I'm Stuart Goldsmith. This is another show recorded live from the Gilded Balloon at the Edinburgh Festival 2013, in which I'll be interviewing David Baddiel, and also in which he turns the tables on me, rather. Without any further ado, here's David Baddiel. Thanks, David. I haven't quite grown out of the... I sort of feel like I should do a slightly formal handshake when inviting people.
Why? Because I'm an OAP?
No, not at all.
Hello, everyone. Thanks for coming. I really liked it when you said, can I just have a small whoop for the podcast? And they really took the small seriously.
Yeah, absolutely.
That was very good.
Well, what we haven't quite got our heads around yet is that, or I haven't got my head around yet, is that the very loyal core audience of the podcast...
Are all here tonight.
Yeah. They're loyal in so much as they really love the show, but they're not necessarily prepared to travel here and or pay for it. But those of you that are more than welcome. Mm. So we were talking just before we came in about the amount of podcasts that you've been doing here.
Yeah.
And you were quite keen that this wasn't another show in which you end up having to do loads and loads of material.
Yeah, well, that's true. Well, it's just one thing. A lot of people ask journalists and stuff about what it's like coming back to doing The Fringe after... Mm-hmm. Well, actually, I haven't not done The Fringe for 16 years. Me and Frank Skinner did Baddiel and Skinner Unplanned here just as a lunchtime show before it was a TV show at the Pleasance in 2000. But it's the first time I've done it as a stand-up show since 1997, so that's 16 mm-hmm. years. And a lot of people ask me what differences are, and one small difference, but actually is quite a significant one, is, of course, the last time I did it properly, it was pre-broadband, believe it or not. It was dial-up. You know, it took a long time to get pornography. And as a result, there are so many of these podcasts now. Mm-hmm. You know, it's a... I said so many of these podcasts now, like an old man. But really, it's the podcast thing. But... yeah, it's a real, and it's different in terms of both in terms of that and in terms of the speed by which it seems to me, you know, you can get stuff out mm-hmm. about your show, or a buzz can happen about your show because of Twitter and because of the internet in general. Mm-hmm. You know, so I have been doing loads of these, but this particular podcast, one reason I did want to do it is that Stuart was telling me that it is a show about comedy. It's a lot of this podcast, they basically want you to come on and do your set for nothing. So I thought I'm more interested in coming on doing the show and not being funny and possibly getting a chance to talk about funny.
Massive walkout. There we go. Absolutely. Well, one of the things that is obviously notable about the show that you're doing at the moment, which is Fame, Not the Musical.
George Square Theatre, 7:30.
Nailed
Quite
it.
Easy to get there from here.
Yeah, and it's on directly after this. Isn't it
is it, on well, directly so after this.
Perfect
yeah.
timing. But you have described it in a previous interview, and I saw it myself a couple of nights ago, as a halfway between a lecture and a stand-up.
Yeah, routine. I wish I hadn't done that because it makes it sound a bit dull.
Yeah, no. Well, I don't think it was dull at all.
But yeah. Well, what I really meant was that what actually happened was that the way that the show got happened, because another thing people have said to me, someone said it to me today on a BBC Four interview, said, why did you decide to come back to stand-up? And like a lot of things in this life, I didn't decide to do anything. Mm. You know, I don't know whether people generally make, unless they're Hitler and they decide to invade Poland, most people don't actually have that sort of front of the head way of living their lives. And what happened with me was I was hosting a show on Radio 4 called Forethought, which I still do. And that is a really great show, I think, because all I do is introduce brilliant people and they talk. It's the only sort of thing you'd only get on Radio 4 about one subject for 14 or 15 minutes. It could be anything from the history of glass to a nurse talking about how awful it is working in terminal children's wards. I mean, kind of amazing stuff. Sure. And it's part of this culture now, which I think is a kind of strange cousin of stand-up, which is what TED has done and a few other things, which is sort of stand-up ideas, not necessarily comedy, although they can be funny.
Sure.
So I got asked to do one of those, I think because I'm on Forethought, which is called 5 times 15 at the Tabernacle in London, which is in West London. And it's the same thing. Mainly writers come on and they talk for 15 minutes just about something they are passionate about or know about. And I thought, I got asked to do that. I thought, what can I talk about? I'll talk about fame, because I kind of know a lot about fame just by virtue of having been in and out of the British public eye over a long period of time. So I did it, and I wrote it differently from the way that I've written stand-up before, because I thought of it as this kind of different culture. So I didn't write it with a view of, like, where's the next gag coming from? And I didn't write bang, bang, but I just thought, I've got something to say about fame, and I'll try and do it with storytelling and with argument and blah, blah, blah. I did know it was comic. I knew there would be fun, there would be laughs, but I didn't expect to hit laughs in the same way. And then it got loads of laughs. I mean, really big laughs. And I thought, oh, maybe this is a way back into doing it. Not that I'd been desperately searching for it, but I thought, I guess I thought, you know, because I had actually done some stand-up on the London cabaret circuit. I'd done 4 gigs just in clubs 2 years before. Just half an hour of new material, completely the same stuff that I did before, observational comedy, not particularly linked by anything except crowbarring one thing to another. And that had been fun, but it didn't feel to me like it was any way moving the form on from what I'd done 12 or 15 years ago. Whereas this, when I did it, I thought, oh, this will be different to what I've done before. So what it actually is it's totally funny all the way through. It's totally got big. I mean, some of the laughs are as big or bigger than I've ever got before. I mean, really, it's hard, bigger, big woofs. But it is all about fame. So it is a concept album. It is all true, because it's all based on stories, absolutely stories that have happened to me in the world of fame. And it does include sad bits and serious bits and, you know, other stuff that I probably wouldn't have included in a straight stand-up show. And it's got a screen.
Did you? And it's got a screen.
It's got a screen.
Nice. Which a lot of stand-up now has, doesn't it? A lot
of
stand-up, since you last were kind of regularly doing stand-up shows at Edinburgh, has changed to encompass a lot of those elements.
Well, I did use a screen, actually, last time I was here. I used it, not as much, but I used it a bit. And I did a routine called Bills of Mortality, which is these I found that had lists of what people died of. That's what they used to publish in the 16th century, 17th century, is lists of what people died of. And they are literally things like fell from the steeple of St. Giles Cripplegate 1, and then like plague 100,000, and so I would bring these up and talk about them, and that was quite early on for using a screen, I think.
Did you find, when you were writing this from the point of view of not needing to write funny, when you were writing for the original lecture, did you find yourself at any point thinking, having said that, it got loads of laughs, did you find yourself thinking, oh, bollocks, I wish I'd written the old stand-up like this, you know, to write, to follow the idea, rather than to feel chased by the need to get laughs?
Maybe a little bit. I mean, insofar as, you know, people really like this show, not that they didn't like it before, but actually I was never a critically revered comedian in any way. I was always a successful comedian and really kind of popular and selling out big venues and all that stuff. But, you know, my incarnation with Rob Newman nor with Frank Skinner were we comedians who particularly liked by, you know, journalists, really. And they do like this one, which is not particularly something that I am pleased about. It would be stupid to say I'm not, but my interest is not them. But I do think my interest is always in trying to express in stand-up or in performance who I actually am. And I think at some level, considering that I went away to write books and films and stuff like that, I guess I haven't in the past quite applied my kind of narrative abilities to stand-up. I'm good with narrative. I'm good at telling a story, and I'm good at creating a whole piece that's got a start, a middle, and an end, and all the rest of it. And I guess, I hadn't really done that before with stand-up.
So is the self-expression that we're talking about, is that's obviously different in stand-up to when you're writing... I mean, even when you write your novels, there's different characters in them, but still an expression of yourself and your ideas. So what's the difference between that sort of writing and the stand-up writing you've been doing more recently? In terms of, because you're writing a narrative about yourself, and it's all, I mean, I assume it's all true.
In terms of it being true, it's a really key thing. I mean, I do a gag at the start, which I might as well do over this, I want to express that the show is true, and I talk about the fact that I do happen to have a kind of OCD, sort of low level on the spectrum thing about truth, which is I hate it, I can't veer any way from the truth. although a few weeks ago I was typing something into Google and my son, who's eight, he was leaning over, and for some reason, I don't know why he said this, he said, "Dad, what would happen if we type the word sexy ladies into there?" And I said, "I don't know." But that is true. That story itself is true. And it is there to say, you know, this is very true. And the true thing is important, because the show really is about the fact that fame will create of you a version out there.
Yes.
There is a version out of you, and it's not who you are. Erica Yong said this thing. She said, "Fame means millions of people will have the wrong idea of who you are."
Sure.
And I would say the more famous you are, the more wronger it is. That's not a good word. More wrong you will be got, the more famous you are. And as a person who is OCD obsessed with the truth and the truth of who I am to some extent, I mean, people will tell you, my friends I think would tell you, quite wearying, in quite a weary way, that I am incredibly me. I never change who I am.
Okay.
I can't, as a result, I'm a very limited performer. I can't do any accents.
Okay.
I'm the kind of comedy performer who, if you see me with a costume on, you just think, well, that's David Baddiel with a costume on. That's
sure,
he doesn't
sure.
meld at all. It's the person he's meant to be. And and so that's just who I am. And then it's weird and comic and disturbing that there is a version of me out there that is not me, and that people have in their minds and sometimes come up and rub against me and whatever. And to some extent, the show is about that. It's about that gap.
Do you think there's a parallel with the stand-up that you wrote about yourself when you were writing stand-up 15 plus years ago? Because I find in the stand-up I write, it's me and it's about me and it's true, but there are kind of corners that I'll cut locations I'll change to try and find. I mean, one way of looking at it is to try and find an internal truth in it, and another way is to make it funnier, to make it sort of work. Were you so obsessed by the truth that you weren't changing anything in any of your anecdotal stand up, or were you prepared?
Well, in the old days,
I
hardly do. I mean, this is a strange thing to say in a way, but I had lunch with Sarah Millican yesterday, who I don't really know, but who's really, really lovely and really, really funny. And then when she met me, we hadn't been able to find each other for various reasons, and I was looking around for her in George Square, and then she arrived, and she told me that she'd just been by the sausage van, and a man had said to her, "Oh, do you want a really extra long bratwurst?" and kind of winked at her, but he had a six-year-old boy next to him. She thought it was a bit weird. And anyway, so that was funny. And then after we had lunch, she tweeted about that, but she said, "Just blah, 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 blah," like it had just happened, which is probably the right way to do it comically, because it seems a bit weird. I would have written 3 hours ago.
Yes, I see.
I would have felt weird about writing "just blah, blah, blah" because of my weird, slightly
compulsion
to always tell the truth, yeah.
And has that got in the way of stand-up?
It's certainly got in the way of my life, without any doubt. It's got in the way of my life. I've said terrible things, not terrible things, but true things. I mean, you know, it's one of the reasons why I think me and Rob Newman split up. In the, you know, I mean, there were lots of reasons why that happened, but one of the reasons was we weren't getting on. He became very, very fixated on certain issues with fame, actually, and sort of like whether we should be called Baddiel and Newman or Newman and Baddiel and all that stuff. Mm-hmm. And one of the things he then insisted on was that we were interviewed separately because, you know, he felt he had things to say that were different. And that was all. I said, okay. So then he would get interviewed separately, and then the journalist would say to me, "So how's it going with Rob?" And I would say, "Oh, I think he's gone mad."
Yeah, right? Okay.
And I actually thought that, but I shouldn't have said it. It's not helpful to say that to journalists.
Sure.
But I didn't really understand, and still don't exactly, the process of censorship or self-inhibition.
Sure.
And that's partly to do with comedy, can I just say? I think it might be interesting. Is that, you know, when I've done ad-libbing and Baddiel and Skinner Unplanned particularly, the way I do that show and kind of the way I've done all comedy when I haven't written anything is I let the stuff come at me from the audience or whatever's happening or whatever, and I return whatever it is I'm going to say as if my mind is a squash wall.
Yes,
is it, or a brick wall that someone's thrown a ball at. It just comes straight back. And that is really how I live my life. That is how I've become a comedian in a way, which is because I don't have self-censorship. And it's not a good way to live your life, but it can be useful for
it's
a comedian.
It's very useful for a comedian to have those skills.
Yeah.
So in the writing of your novels, how did that process work in terms of the squash wall analogy?
Yeah. It's a bit different in writing a novel.
Sure.
I mean, because I think, you know, that is how I am as a performer, and particularly as a performer for things like Unplanned or improvisation of any sort, or just being on stage. And, you know, when I first started comparing The Comedy Store, which I was doing in the late 80s, for crying out loud. Seems like it was obviously a long time ago, but that was how I moved from being a comedian who just had 20 minutes that he stuck to rigidly, and somebody would compare the Comedy Store and got heckled at and whatever, and I thought, oh, this is what I'll do. I'll just... the first thing that comes into my head will come, and I will trust that it will be funny. And it doesn't mean it's always funny, but something will come if you just keep going.
There is something about a friend of mine who's a street performer said to me years ago about dealing with audience situations, improvising with an audience, is that if you keep batting things back, if you keep saying the first thing on your mind, then they don't all need to be funny, because every so often one of them will be, the audience will laugh, and then afterwards they'll only remember the stuff that they laughed at.
That's useful, but also the honesty of it. I think it responds better than pre-prepared heckle, put-downs or whatever. But I think with writing, I do think novel writing can be incredibly self-expressive as well, but then obviously you do have to put yourself into other characters and you do have to think of a story and all the rest of it, which is not true anymore. And although I have fucked people off with stuff in my novels that they are convinced is stuff that happened to me in my life, but let's leave that out. I don't know exactly what the answer to that is. I guess the answer would be that if you've got this type of head that I've got, you have a very convinced, instinctive idea of what it is you want to say. And that just travels in a different way into a novel. You feel like, okay, I know in my own way, with my own little tuning fork in my head, that this is right. This is the story I want to tell. Sure. This is the sentence I want to write.
So is the when you do sit down and write stand-up, is that kind of halfway between that process of the improvised stuff and the longer form novelization?
I suppose it is. I mean, now to say it's different, this show is different from how I used to write. How I used to write stand-up was really like, I've thought of a funny thing, I will write that down, and now I'll think of another funny thing and I will crowbar it together. Or a funny thing has happened to me and I will tell that story, and the way I would tell it tended to be ultra-truthful and whatever. I still included lots of stories.
Sure.
But there was a bit more, you know, what was that?
That's the end of the round.
Bell.
Yeah, I don't know what that was.
Yeah, it's really worried. Yeah, I thought I've got a dinner service at the right. But what is that? Is there a bicycle in here?
Is that someone's
like phone? A 1940s bicycle in here. Oh, fantastic.
Man rolling around selling onions. No.
Okay. Well, that's really weird.
Let's see if it happens again.
What was the question?
We were talking about the all I can think of is a man driving a bicycle around. Yeah. Sorry.
Has anyone been listening? Can you remember the question?
We were talking about the writing of stand-up as something in between those two.
Oh, yeah.
Anecdotal stuff and kind of things that have happened to you.
I should know this, but how long have you been a stand-up?
About 9 years.
Right. And when did you do your first long show?
3 or 4 years ago.
So when you came to do your first long show, how did you find the process of, like, because 20 minutes of stand-up, you can kind of cobble together, can't you, from just, here's some funny things I've thought of,
absolutely,
and I'll find a way of coasting from it. But then when you do a longer show, it starts to be more like novel writing, I think.
I was trying to tell a story. I was trying to tell a story about my background as a street performer, and also the fact that I enjoy going to fetish clubs.
Oh, do you?
And yet I'm a very boring, normal person.
Boral is a fabulous Freudian slip. It's got boring and oral in it. It's fantastic.
I am tremendously boral. I wish I'd thought of that for a title when the show came out. But I was trying to... I realised that for all of those sort of supposedly exciting elements of my life, I'm a fleece-wearing, you know, sensible shoe.
I have to say, I wouldn't look at you and think that bloke is into BDSM.
Well, that was very much
an angle. It's not a version of the Noel Gallagher or whatever it is. Liam Gallagher Group BDI. It stands for bond. What does it stand for? Bondage, sadomasochism.
Bondage, dominism, all right. Domination and sadomasochism.
Okay, yeah. You're a man who knows.
This isn't the direction I planned. And given that of these interviews, this is one my mum will almost certainly be listening to.
Yeah.
But that was the point. People say that to me a lot, that I look very normal. I can sort of pass undetected as a normal
through
person.
Through us, but, through the normal people.
Well, yeah, maybe. But yeah. But equally, you know, I went to circus school and I kind of breathe fire and do all that kind of stuff that maybe you wouldn't expect as well. So in the writing of that show, I had some jokes that were about those things already. And then I tried to sit...
No, I'm really interested in comedy. I have to know what kind of fetish clubs you went to.
You didn't want to sit and do material.
No, I'm not doing material. That's me being honest. I could feel a compulsion to ask you that and not be interested in the fucking stand-up. So I'm sorry. I couldn't help myself.
I went to very much the vanilla end. Are you familiar with that term?
An ice cream club?
Yeah, a little bit. The lighter end of the fetish circuit. I wasn't a sort of hardcore person at all.
Okay.
But in the show, for example, I told a story about being spanked without being asking for it. I was there on a sort of reconnaissance, you know, checking the thing out. And someone snuck up behind me and whacked me on the bum with a riding crop.
Really?
Which really hurt because I was only wearing a nightie. So
Is that true?
That's true. That genuinely happened, yeah.
You were wearing a nightie?
I was wearing a nightie.
So when you say vanilla... It was quite advanced.
It was quite covered up. I mean, a nightie is... I mean, well, it was practically see-through.
But why are you wearing a nightie?
Because I was experimenting with what I wanted to wear in that environment.
Yeah, but a nightie.
Yeah, it was fun.
What, like a Winsett nightie? Like what? An
I don't
old
know
style.
What that means.
No,
but
well,
like
I don't know either, but it's what I've heard it. I've heard it.
I'm,
like
I'm compelled to point out that I don't know what that means. Yeah. No, it was down. It was below the jacket.
Yeah, what, like a sort of thing you get on 70s Dolly Birds thing, where it's a frilly nightie that just covers your arse?
Well, David, it was a little bit more tasteful.
And there's a bloke on the
bus
is chasing you around. Benny Hill is chasing you around a tree.
She was a terrifying female Benny Hill with a fucking riding crop. Wow. Yeah. But where were we? We were... That show, that story is told on the album on the business cards that you can download free that are on all your seats. Stuartgoldsmith.co.uk/album for any listeners.
So you were telling that story.
So I was trying to tell, I had some material about that. I had some material that was, I guess, a combination of the dirty material that a new comic writes and does because it's sort of more successful because there's an element of outrage, and combined with something that I thought, oh, this could actually be my angle, is I seem very happy and candid talking about the, you know, the fringes of sexuality.
Right.
So I had some of that material, and then I tried to write a story through it that would draw it together. But I felt like I was trying to bash out a novel because I really spent, I know you're laughing.
I expect more from the audience of this show. You told me this was a high class podcast. I thought I'm going to leave bash out.
But I put a lot of work into the plotting of the show, into what I wanted the narrative arc to be, I'm sure a lot of comedians feel this of their first hour, years into my career, 6 years or so, that I really wanted it to be like my calling card, my statement, here I am, this is the story.
Yeah.
So I put a lot of work into trying to make that all work. At the same time, of course, a lot of other comedians doing their first hour went, I'm going to get all my funniest stuff. I'm not going to spend any time worrying. I spent a lot of time worrying and going, how can I fit? I'm sure that's in there somewhere. How can I chisel that out? And that time could arguably have been better spent writing new and different stuff, trying it in clubs and ending up with a much bigger bag of material to take from.
Maybe. I mean, certainly when I mean, the thing is, by the time I was doing an act, it's a bit different for me because I was doing the cabaret circuit and loads and loads of gigs on the cabaret circuit, kind of two or three gigs a night and comparing the comedy, so all that stuff. But I didn't actually do an hour until I was on telly.
Sure.
Right? Okay. And that made a big difference, to be honest, because one of the things about being on telly, which was like really, really, I felt this difference, and I'm sure any comedian could tell you the truth, is that if you go on stage at the Comedy Store late night and no one's heard of you, even if you were a well-practiced comedian, you still have to win the audience over.
Yes.
And you have to be careful because, you know, one joke that goes badly and they're probably off.
Sure.
Whereas if people are paying to see you and they really want you to be good, it's a whole different attitude. Because there's a bit, I don't know if there is.
I can only imagine. Yeah,
but there is a bit. I mean, I might be nicer now. I doubt it. But I mean, my first gig in London was at 3 o'clock in the morning at the Comedy Store after there'd been a fight. And it was really like playing to dead people, really. It was like The Returned.
I've been
playing
that.
In the Lake Pub.
I've been avoiding your Twitter feed because you've been spoiling The Returned.
I'm sorry about The Returned. I don't know if anyone see it. Channel 4 show about very nice looking zombies. Anyway, and then suddenly, I remember me and Rob Newman doing a gig at this place called The Venue in South London, and loads of people turned up for it, and I realised, I can do stuff that might not work, because they'll let me get away with it. Not for that long, not for 20 minutes, but for 5 minutes, you could probably get away with not... You won't get booed off, because they like you already. And that actually meant you could be more experimental, weirdly, in a way that probably the critical understanding of comedy is the other way around. It's like, oh no, if it's got to be the young, obscure comedian who's doing the great things and all the famous comedians are just riding on there. But actually, I didn't find that. I found, oh, now that I'm not so worried that I'm going to get booed off by hard men because I've told one shit joke, I can do some stuff that might be different. So I started doing like an hour and a half at that point. And it was fine. It was, you know, I'm really happy with the stand-up that I did then. Mm-hmm. But I do think the stuff I'm doing now is kind of more interesting.
Is there any way, do you think, for an aspiring comedian or a newer comedian to try and replicate, to try and artificially create that environment where you can take those risks? Without being famous.
Well,
because I think some of the most exciting comedians at the moment seem to have... I saw Claudio O'Doherty's show last night,
right,
which is incredibly exciting, and it made me feel like the first time I watched The Day Today. Just went, oh my God, the rules are completely different.
Right.
And I wonder if that's because she, by some combination of her personality, has got the brass neck to stand there and be prepared to fail.
Well,
and as a result, she discovers much more.
I don't know if this is a female thing, but Sarah Pascoe said exactly that to me the other day. She does Set List, which I don't know if you've heard of that. It's this thing that comedians do now, which I wouldn't have the balls to do, I don't think, where they just stand on stage late night. Here, is it the Gilded Balloon? It happens.
Yeah, it's different this year. I'm not sure.
All right. Well, anyway, it's a thing whereby a set list, obviously, is something that a comedian or a... Well, let's forget about what bands might have, but where they'll have just a list of topics that they might be talking about. But in set list, the show is it just comes up on a screen and they've never seen it before.
Mm-hmm.
So it might just say Conkers or, you know, the...
Yeah, I had... what did I have? I had Pol Pot Pie Factory.
Really?
Yeah.
Wow.
They're deliberately, to ensure that you can't do existing material.
Right, okay. Yeah. So she was just going off to do it, and I said, aren't you nervous? And she said, yeah, a bit, but she said, the key is not to be frightened of failure. And of course, that is correct. Even though someone's just fallen over.
Impeccable timing.
The thought of it.
Yeah, that's the guy's come off his bike.
Yeah. But I think it's someone for your fetish club, actually. But think that is obviously key. I think it's hard. You know, it's fair enough to say, don't be frightened of failure, but actually, you know, going on stage and dying, which has happened to all of us, dying is a correct word to say, because it is as close, I imagine, not having actually physically lost the use of my organs, to feeling like death as you could possibly feel. So it's an incredibly brave thing to say, I am not frightened of that experience. If it happens, it happens, you know. But I guess...
Do you think that... I mean, if you're not sort of someone who's in Pascoe's camp of going, I'm just not going to be frightened of it. If you've suffered the fear that a lot more of us have suffered, I think, than haven't. Do you think that's ever held you back in your stand-up practice? Do you feel that there are more creative leaps you could have taken?
There were loads of reasons why I stopped doing stand-up. Mm. But one of them, without any doubt, was the fact that stand-up blows everything else out of your head because of that. So when you've got a gig that night, you basically always have some sense of dread, I think. And it's very hard to do stuff like I wanted to do, like write films and books and later on see my children without other stuff being on my mind and stuff like that. And I just thought, I am not able to live my life either artistically or emotionally while I'm doing this every night of the week, which at one point I was, you know, I was touring constantly and all the rest of it and doing really, really big venues and all the rest of it. And even if it was that stage I talked about where people were coming to see me, so the pressure was off a bit, it's still very anxiety creating.
Mm.
So that was one reason why I stopped doing it. And that's still there. I mean, when I come back now, you know, I don't have no anxiety about doing it at all.
Sure.
But I think it's fine. I mean, I'm always... I don't know whether I'm a comedian who I do get sometimes very anxious and then I step on stage and then I'm not.
I could definitely relate to that.
But Frank Skinner is a comedian who has no anxiety at all about performing. And actually, I'd never met that before. When I shared a flat with Frank in 1990 here, when he won the Perrier, as it then was, we were walking to the Pleasance from our flat and I got to the Pleasance courtyard and I said to him, you're on in 2 minutes. And he went, yeah. I couldn't believe it. I mean, I would have been pacing about and getting cross with people and having to drink water and go to the toilet and all that stuff. But he just walked on, treasure and walked on. And that's, you know, just the way it is for him. But for me, it wasn't like that.
Was there a part of you that was sad about that, that would have liked to have been like that?
I don't think so, because that wouldn't have been me. I am neurotic, you know, and I am Jewish, and I am the person who I am. And that's the way that I perform. And actually, I get something out of that transformation from feeling anxious and dreadful and suddenly walking on stage and it's okay.
Sure.
There's some huge, you know, that's part of the joy of performing for me, is that suddenly slipping away. So, yeah, no, I'm fine with it.
Well, we've all learnt quite a lot about David so far, as well as something about Stuart. Moving on, however, I'm very pleased with this one. I'm very excited by the squash court analogy. I think it's a great way of putting it, just the idea with it with improvising being to return the serve. I think that's a really apt way of describing that. More fascinating stuff on Fame and on David's writing technique coming up in a moment. I was famous myself for about 3 weeks a few years ago due to a television programme, and it really unsettled me. I don't know if I'd like to go through that again. I found it very, very weird. But having said that, if I absolutely had to, I would probably cope. A couple of your emails now. Thanks for these. You can always tweet me at ComComPod or email me info@comedianscomedian.com. This is an email from Stuart Baggs, who works as a school caretaker and often listens to the podcast as the soundtrack. He says, thank you for introducing me to new comics. There are some podcasts I skip past if I do not know the guest, but not yours. And he also goes on to say, I will donate when I have the spare cash, brackets, I know that's not your aim. Beautifully put, Stuart. Thanks for bringing that up. And I do think it's funny, I sometimes speak to people who are a fan of this show, and they say, oh yeah, I skip past people I haven't heard of. Trust me, if I'm interviewing someone on the show, they are absolutely worth hearing from. So do, if you've missed any names you didn't know, some of the most exciting ideas, I mean, a lot of you won't know or have otherwise heard of Alistair Tremblay-Birchall. He was one of the acts I did in Australia earlier this year, and he's very, very new, but there is absolutely loads to enjoy from that one. So it is worth going back and listening to those. Thanks for bringing up the subject of donation. More on that in a second. And this is from Roger Clark. Your podcast has been both inspiring and terrifying. I'd love to do stand-up, but it sounds like a hard, hard life. Not an easy option, and the travelling hours scare me. But I already travel a lot for the company, so perhaps it shouldn't scare me too much. Good point. Anyway, the podcast has certainly made a big difference, and that, combined with the improv that Roger's been doing, has convinced me to try it out and see what happens. If I didn't try, I'd never know how good I could have been. Proper thanks, Roger. Well, thank you very much, Roger and Stuart, for emailing in. I'm very happy to field all of your emails. I'm glad that so many of you are getting so much out of the show. I suppose when I started doing this show a little bit over a year ago, it, quite quickly people started saying, oh, thanks for the show. I'm thinking about giving it a go. And I must admit, part of me thought, don't do that. There's too many comics already. But I think I've gotten over myself on that respect. And if it is inspiring anyone to try doing stand-up, then why not? Let's bloody embrace it. I think we can always need we can always use more good ones. So thank you very much for your energy. We mentioned some of those emails mentioned supporting the show. You can of course go to www.comedianscomedian.com and click on the PayPal donate button. This is the way to become a hyper goldsmith. That's a new thing I've invented. Super goldsmiths, of course, are anyone who tweets to their following about the show. A hyper goldsmith, you simply donate me some money, and in return you get loads of great stuff, none of it tangible, most of it things like the feeling of having support, well, all of it, the feeling of having supported a thing you like. And on that note, a special mention to the excellent comedy producer David Allison, who created the fabulous This Is Your Trial show and format, which is available now for gigs and one-off tailored events and stag do's and so forth from thisisyourlaugh.co.uk. David is always first with a new idea, and he's one of those rare people who really actually gets round to doing them. He suggested on Facebook recently a system of asking from people you know that instead of giving you a Christmas present that they donate to your favourite podcast, sort of like buying someone a virtual goat. Great idea. So fire away if you'd like to do that. Comedianscomedian.com, hit the donate button. You can select the amount you'd like to donate. And I like to think the people who can afford the show, can afford to give me some money, pay for the ones who can't. So that's all the blurb. A couple of little plugs at the end. But now let's get back to David Baddiel.
I wondered when you came out to do the show that I saw the other night, does any, and this isn't related to your performance, which I thought was excellent, but after a long gap of holding together a solo show yourself, is there a part of you that feels less than match fit? Is there a part of you that feels ring rusty?
Oh, no, completely. I mean, that show that you saw the other night is, I've done Soho Theatre as work in progress nights four times, four runs. Mm-hmm. So week or five nights or whatever run, so that you will have seen the 22nd, 23rd performance of, of a show that I started creating last November. And it's still not that much, actually. I don't think that's not loads and loads. But certainly when I first decided to do... when I did that talk, and then about 2 months later, or whatever it was, I'd put together an hour, actually it was about an hour and a half of stuff in order to do a show at Soho Theatre. Okay. Working, but I was terrified.
When you say you put it together, but can you be more specific about that process of, were you collating anecdotes? And
well, the show is built around stories. It's very built around storytelling of things that have happened to me in the wild and wonderful world of British show business. And so I did spend a lot of time just thinking back to stuff that happened to me. And then I also very much thought about, what do I want to say? And so the movement from story to story isn't just, here's another story. It's very much following a course of, you know, this is the particular type of fame that I want to talk about. This is how it can get out of hand. This is what it actually does to you as a person, blah, 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 blah. And so, yeah, I put that together, but it was a mess, I think, when I first did it.
Was that mess from... Were you? I mean, did you ever get to the stage? Were you writing fame in a circle and doing spider diagrams?
No, I can't do that. I've never been able to do that. And actually, I do it because I write novels. I do quite a lot of literary festivals, and actually, you're there with a stand-up version of the question you most get asked, which is, how do you actually write? And by they don't mean like where do you get your ideas from? Really, what they mean is, do you use a typewriter?
Yeah, what colours your notebook?
Yeah, exactly. Your notebook. You put stuff up on the wall. I'm like, no, I don't do any of that. I've done any of that with novels, with the films I've written, or with stand-up. I just write stuff down and then hold it in my head, what I'm trying to create.
Okay. So with coming back to the show again, I wondered if there was an element by which doing a show that is half stand-up and half lecture provided a kind of safety net for you as someone that hadn't done a stand-up show for a while. Given that stand-up can... I know you've sort of already answered this question with the sort of the origin of it in the TED Talks lecture. But given that stand-up can talk about ideas, and it would be possible for you, I'm sure, to do an hour's stand-up show about fame and discuss those ideas, but with less of a sort of lecture, show-and-tell kind of presentation element. Did that occur to you? Or could you see that happening in the future of the show?
Well, I mean, to be honest, you know, I kind of think it is a stand-up show. It's not... If you saw my 1997 show, which does use a screen a lot, I think the reason I use a screen is, one is, you know, I quite like it, you know, breaking it up with some visual stuff. But the other is, it's on a deeper level. It's to do with the truth thing. Like, I tell a story about Madonna, right? Shall I tell the story?
I don't want to spoil anything from your show, and I don't want to make you do material, but illustrate it.
Well, look, I tell this story, which is, the point of the story is not to tell a story, actually. What I'm talking about is the strange hierarchies of fame and the humiliations of fame. And I talk about how it's very humiliating. It can be very humiliating meeting famous people if you're also famous, but not as famous as them. And I was walking around backstage at Live 8 with Ricky Gervais, and Madonna appeared from nowhere.
Have you heard of those people?
And Madonna said to Ricky, I mean, she really appeared, I thought, fucking hell, it's Madonna, and said to Ricky, oh, I love your show. I would sweep up on set if you asked me to. I'd do anything to work with you. I am your biggest fan. And Ricky, rather brilliantly, said, and you are? And Madonna, rather brilliantly, said, Paris Hilton, right? Which really raised her in my comic estimation. And then, when Madonna's around, clearly big stars appear from nowhere, David Walliams appeared, and she said to him, oh, I love your show. I'm a lady. It's so funny. And David was really grateful and flattered. And then Ricky said, oh, and this is David Baddiel. And Madonna said, hi. And then just to make it worse, they all went off, and her sound engineer went, oh, I like you. So that was terrible. But then I told that story, and then I happened to be Googling something else, and I found a picture of me and Ricky and a few other people talking to Madonna at the time, which had a gag in it. And I may as well reveal it. Now, this gag was given to me by Danny Wallace. Okay. You know Danny Wallace?
Yes,
He saw the show. He said, I'm not going to tell you what that is. He said, you should say this. It gets a huge laugh.
Yes, and absolutely.
It makes me want to hug Danny Wallace, actually, who I don't know that well. But... you know, I don't know if you've ever had that experience.
Yeah, absolutely.
Comedian just suggests something.
Sure.
And often it's a quite sort of complicated moment if a comedian does that.
Yes.
Actually, can I tell a little story?
Go on, by all means.
About that. Because it's really, you know, actually, I was doing work in progress nights anyway. And if you're doing work in progress nights, you quite want people to suggest things. So some comedians have come and been really nice, but said, what about this? And that's totally fine. Mm. But other times it can be a bit like, who do you think you are telling me what? And I had that experience when I went to see Chris Rock. I went to see Chris Rock, right? And he was brilliant, but he was doing this bit at the time, this was about 6 or 7 years ago, about how if someone pisses you off, then it's all right to be really offensive to them if there's something about them you can be offensive about. And he used an example. He talked about someone with one leg crashing into his car, and then he did a long rant about you fucking one-legged blah, 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 you one-legged whatever. And it was a funny bit, but he had, in his show, hardly done any reference to being in Britain. So I met him afterwards, and I said to him, sorry, he had no idea who I was a comedian. I said, sorry, I'm a comedian. I know it's really weird suggesting this, but I think it will go really well if after you've done the whole one-legged bit, you just take a breath and you go, Heather, right? Like, she's been shouting. And this was the time that Heather Mills was an enormous kind of figure in the British public imagination. And Chris Rock really politely wrote it down and then went, why? Right? It was incredibly embarrassing. He said, why? And I said, well, you know Heather Mills? And he didn't really. And I said, well, she's got one leg. And I was really wishing I hadn't said it. And you know, I think it'll go well or whatever. So I was really embarrassed. I went away. 3 days later, Frank Skinner was around at my house. I told him the story. I said, I was really, really embarrassed. And he said to me, yeah, I went to see him yesterday. He's doing it. He's saying Heather, it gets a huge laugh. And then he says, some English guy told me to say that. I don't really get it. Isn't that amazing?
I've had that experience. There's a particular bit I've got in from last year's show that I'm still using on the circuit, which was the shame is it's the best punchline in the routine because right. It all works, and then there's just a little topper on the end that someone gave me,
right.
And you kind of never want to tell anyone, and you know.
Well, this is the first time I've admitted that, which I haven't told you what it is, but because it involves the screen.
But actually, Daddy Wallace gave it to me.
You heard it here first. A tiny part, but the truth impulse I can't stop myself. There is no way I could ever claim that was mine. The best sure. I could ever do is not mention it, and now it's come up. I've got to say it.
None of you are allowed to shout, Daddy Wallace. after that moment. When you go and see that moment in David's show. Just talking about the structuring of the show before we come on to some questions, I was wondering if you could give me an example of something that, a piece of material that you wrote for the Fame show and then didn't use, something that was binned, and why, and what those decisions were.
Well, the vast majority of it was stuff that in the end, even if it got really big laughs, I thought was not really about the subject matter. Because I really, really wanted this to feel like a piece, like a theatrical piece, or like, you know, still totally stand-up rooted, but like a theatrical piece that felt like, okay, we've gone on a journey with David and we've come out of it. And there was loads and loads. I mean, some of it pretty on the money, but still felt, I mean, for example, I used to do this bit about The Infidel, which is the film that I wrote with Omid Jalili in it a couple of years ago, and that's about showbiz and about fame, and I talked about the fact that when that came out, that film, because it's about a Muslim who discovers he was adopted and born a Jew, that I was really, really worried about offending both communities. Well, I say both communities, obviously I mean Muslims, because, you know, what are the Jews going to do? You know, ban me from Carmelis in Golders Green, I'll be okay. And then I tell this story, which is a true story, which is that I was worried enough at the first ever meeting with the distributor, who'd been quite hard to find, the distributor, to suggest this tagline for the movie, which was funny, feel good, and fatwa free. And then one of the distributors, a young guy in the meeting, went, what's a fatwa? And I thought, oh, now I understand why you've chosen to distribute this movie. Yeah. Right? and I don't do that in the show now, because it's a funny story, but even though it's about showbiz, whatever, it doesn't fit into
my... It's peripherally related.
Yeah, it's not really related to what I'm saying in general.
Okay.
I remember... I could tell you exactly, and this is very kind of mechanical and detailed or whatever, but you might be interested in it, which is it's to do with the link from the previous bit of material. That sort of told me this is a bit of a crowbar.
Okay.
So the previous bit of material is quite a long bit about how one of the things about being well known is that if you make a mistake, a small, tiny mistake, it will be magnified into something enormous. And I used examples of various things that have happened to me in the presence of Russell Brand, who I'm a friend of, to explain this. A massive, ridiculous... I mean, I basically broke up Russell Brand's marriage due to a small error about the size of a charity swim in Cornwall. You have to see the show to explain what I mean. But it completely is organic to what I'm talking about. And then when I was doing the show that included that bit about the infidel, that bit would have happened. And I remember saying something like, yeah, but the thing about fame is sometimes small little mistakes that other people make can actually benefit you.
Yes.
And then that would tell that story.
Okay.
About
that feel, that's and a, that didn't feel like a true
that's
thing
a,
to say.
That's a linking bit, just to get in the story. It's not a real bit, if you see what I mean.
Absolutely, yeah. With the result that because of that level of quality control, the show that you're doing, all you know, you can't level that accusation at it because it's it all follows on. It all makes sense.
Yeah, it does, yeah. I hope so.
There's a couple of other things I really want to talk about, but I feel there's an opportunity. You've all sat awfully attentively. So I'm doing the school teacher thing.
Do you have any questions?
Any questions
anyone?
For David?
This is always a terrible bit. It's a terrible bit. I think people might do. Normally, in my experience of asking always if I've got any questions, there's like that bit that we've just done where people think, oh, I have, but I'm too shy.
And then one person does.
Yeah, normally someone does. I could be wrong, but does anyone... Let's try again. Does anyone have any questions at all? You look like you do, just the way you're looking at me. That's a kind of Darren Brown thing I've done there. I've read your body language. Cold reading.
Well, like Darren Brown, you've basically told him to do something and instructed him to do it.
I did used to in the past, yeah.
Like Mock the Week and 8 out of 10 cats. I take it.
No, no, I've been asked. I've done 8 out of 10 cats 3 times. And actually, 8 out of 10 cats was one of the things. A few things happened to me. I talk about this in the show, why I gave up, performing all the time. And I talk about a corporate gig that went really, really wrong. But actually, it was also, I was on 8 out of 10 cats. And I remember thinking, fuck me, this is like being in a car park where 6 drunk men are trying to shout louder than each other to prove they're the really funny one. And I really hated it. I mean, the show's still funny, and I like all the people right, but I just thought, well, I can't be fucked. I can't be bothered to try and prove that I've got the biggest comedy balls on this particular table, you know. That's a very honest
move on.
You know what I mean, yeah. I couldn't think of what the collective piece of furniture for balls was.
The balls would go on.
Yeah, balls
would
go on. You should know,
really.
You should know, yeah, definitely. It'll be some kind of weird solitaire plate. And Mock the Week, I was actually asked to be a captain on Mock the Week when it first started. And that was absolutely at a time when I thought that is not what I want to do anymore. I didn't know that the show was going to be what it was, and the show is very good at what it does. But I remember Dan Patterson, the producer, phoning me up, and I think Billy and Skinner Unplanned had just ended. And I'd spent a lot of time on that show, which I am really proud of Unplanned, because I think even though it was often not that great, it did, when it had its best, do something which no other show has done, which is it really, really was me and Frank just talking normally with no sort of nothing made up, nothing added
nothing
on.
Rigged
nothing rigged.
Nothing
rigged. It was incredibly part of that honesty thing again. Mm. I think I was trying to do a show which really showed who I was. Mm. And obviously still there's some kind of difference comes through. But anyway, so he said to me, I said to him, is it going to be a show where you're allowed to talk properly, like properly in real life like people do, or is it just going to be gag, gag, gag? He said, no, absolutely, it's going to be conversational and whatever. And something about the way he said it made me think, no, it isn't. And so I didn't do it, and I think I was right. I mean, it's a funny show, but it is not how people talk in real life. It is, you know, one gag, gag, gag after another, and I didn't want to do that for whatever reason. It wasn't right for me anymore.
I wondered whether you talk a lot in the show about Twitter and about trolls and the sort of internet hatred and the fact that you feel your name became like sort of this character, the invented character of David Baddiel, became a target for abuse.
Yeah.
And I was going to ask about whether you think that you might have invited that criticism by being a kind of a critical stand-up yourself and kind of mocking people.
Well, no, but I talk about it in the show.
Yeah,
as
absolutely.
You know, in the show, I talk about when I, which is also true, when I decided I wasn't ever going to do material that might upset people I didn't feel were deserving of it anymore, which is most people, actually. Mm-hmm. I now never really do any material or on Twitter or anything that I write that I think is really going to upset.
You think has a human
a
victim.
A specific human face, yeah. I never do it. And it's that's restricting.
Sure.
But I think it's really important to me. I have developed quite a strong sense of empathy, which has come to me a bit whilst I'm sort of a bit on the spectrum, has come to me a bit through being attacked myself.
Okay.
And thinking, oh, it's really, really horrible.
Sure.
You know, and these people who are attacking me, they don't have any sense of what that creates in me. That must be the same for when I attack people. So I stopped doing it.
Yes.
I used to do it a lot when I was just starting out.
I just wondered whether in the context of doing those panel games, or oh, sorry, not the panel games, but in the context of doing the unplanned show and you being absolutely yourself, that maybe also the reason why you were the target of such sort of, you know, really kind of angry criticism, or apparently angry criticism, might be because you were warts and all. You were being entirely yourself and not cutting away to nail a joke.
Do you think this gentleman's got a question, so shall we take that and then I'll come back to
sure.
that?
Sure.
Just jumping back to the internet thing.
Yeah.
Do you feel as a comedian now that with all the stuff that's going on the internet, you are getting sensitised?
I'm not quite sure what you mean by sensitised. Oh, censored.
Yeah.
Censored.
All right. Well, certainly, there's no question, obviously, on Twitter especially, that if you say something could be taken out of context, next thing you know, you can have the most incredible storm over your head. And, yeah, I think that is a bit of a problem. And I think it was Alan Carr who once said that Twitter is like talking to a maiden aunt who doesn't understand sarcasm, because it is true that you can say something on Twitter that is obviously a joke and it will be taken in the most literal... In fact, here's an example. And actually, this is something I thought about including in the show as well, but I haven't included it, which is... And this probably would have fitted in, but I just kind of felt the show was too long. When ITV did that, an audience with Les Dawson thing that was on a while back, do you see that? They took a hologram. It was a really weird and creepy show, I thought. A hologram of Les Dawson, and he did the an audience with that he would have done had he not died. So I tweeted at the time, oh, if you can do an audience with Les Dawson, why can we not have the trial of Jimmy Savile? And someone tweeted me, I don't think that would be permissible in a court of law, right? And there is no doubt that was not a joke, because there was no element at all in which it was a joke. And why bother, in a way, with a joke? Yeah. So, and I just think someone on Twitter, if you do a joke, will take it literally, however obvious a joke it is. And, you know, if you could fall over on a banana skin on Twitter, someone would say you should not have left that banana there. That's bad. And so it is true that it's a problem, but I try as much as possible to say what I want to say whilst being aware of that stuff.
Given that you're... that you are now, you suggest that your Twitter usage now is not your Twitter usage, your use of targets in comedy.
Yeah, you know, you were talking about that before, sorry. Yeah.
Yes, yeah, that's okay.
Did you think that I was, you said, a victim because of the warts and all?
Well, I wondered if because
you
really
present... I think there's lots of reasons for it. I mean, you know, I think when I first started, I was still doing lots of attacks on people. You know, I mean, this wasn't, you know, when I first, the first year of American Rights Students had a bit of that in it. It was pretty brash. My sort of demeanour was quite, you know, probably quite arrogant, but also as a class thing. You know, in Britain, it's very extraordinary still. Everyone has to be pegged within whatever ideas of class there are.
Sure.
So because there is no, and I talk about this a lot in the show, no complexity in the understanding of personality on TV, I was pegged very quickly as being middle class because I went to Oxbridge. In fact, my background is really complicated because my mother's a refugee from Nazism and my dad is a working class Welsh bloke or whatever. And I was clever, so I went to Cambridge, but that is nothing to do with my class or whatever. Sure. But I don't care. I would never spend a lot of time saying so. I'm not, because I think it doesn't matter.
Yes.
It's nothing to do with whether you're funny, nothing to do with who you are, how much money your parents earn, you know. But there's a desperation to peg you as something like that, and that immediately will fire into people who want to slag you off for whatever reason or whatever.
Sure. I was going to ask about whether... Yeah, I've forgotten where I was. I'm sorry. This is the first time I've done this in the run. We've talked about several things.
It's all right. Don't worry.
I'm just stopping now. You pour that water.
Does anyone else got any questions while Stuart's having a breakdown?
No. I'm just pausing.
Yes, this gentleman has a question.
In the edit of the podcast, I can cut out this. So only 20 of you need to know.
Yeah, sorry.
Go on, I'll scribble.
Yeah. Did you were you at the Falkirk gig?
Not
free, no. Why did you not come to the Falkirk gig? Oh, okay, that's fair enough. No, I thought that I couldn't be bothered. In Falkirk, not really, although I do know Eric Joyce a little bit, the MP for Falkirk. And I did come on at the Falkirk gig. And I thought, God, this is the first time I've done the show properly in a proper room, because I've been doing it in Soho in front of like 50, 100 people. And there were a few more than that at Falkirk, and I thought I shouldn't mess about. But I came on and said, hello, I am your new Labour candidate. And it got a huge laugh. I thought, oh, thank God, I can still bugger about with stuff and still get laughs. You know?
Sure. We're back in the room. I wanted to ask about, and this is something that's sort of one of my fixations about comedy, is whether... Given how honest, autobiographical your material is, and that you are expressing yourself, do you feel that you benefit from that expression? Do you feel that your shows and that your work has ever had a kind of positive healing effect on you as it might be when you
as
say...
As a person?
Yes, well, as a person. When you write a novel and you go, right, I've got that out.
I don't know. It's the truth with that. I think it's more a compulsion to do it, and therefore, you know, bottling up a compulsion presumably gives you cancer. So, sure. I mean, I'm not a doctor, <Presumably. laughs> so don't take that to heart. Don't just do anything you want to do. But I do think, you know, that I don't... I mean, it's hard. Like, yesterday, the projector went down and we were showing up 40 minutes late and we were within inches of calling off the show. Mm-hmm. And I was backstage, having got quite relaxed actually with the show by my standards, absolutely in pieces and really, really upset and kind of angry and whatever. And I did think, oh no, this is doing real damage to my health again.
Yes,
which sometimes I feel stand-up can do. Mm-hmm. Yeah, that is why Tommy Cooper died on stage. That's why Eric Morecambe died young. It is an incredibly,
an adrenaline kind of rush.
Yeah, and I really, I mean, I felt, and I went, when I went on, actually, I mean, I think the gig was fine, but mm-hmm. I could feel inside I wasn't at all like you should be, like relaxed and happy to go on. And I think, so it's hard to say that stand-up is actually improving your kind of spiritual or psychic health when sure. shit like that can happen. But I do think that there must be something about the process of self-expression that mm. I am drawn to and which mm. must therefore be good for me at some level.
And are there any elements to your stand-up? Well, I'll ask that in a moment. First, what are you planning to do beyond this? Are you planning to return to a life in stand-up after having done this show?
Not a life in stand-up like I used to have. I used to have, like, you know, basically I was gigging either before I was well-known in clubs 7 or 8 times a week, or when I was doing shows with Rob Newman and indeed Frank, you know, we'd be talking about touring the country 100, mm-hmm. 150 gigs a year. No. I'm not going to do that because I think I am too interested in writing other stuff, and also because of the family and all that stuff. And yeah, just because, and the other reason, obviously, and I don't know, is that when I was younger, I used to occasionally sleep with women after gigs. I'm not allowed to do that anymore. and I think that is a big reason not to do stand-up anymore. Billy Connolly once said to me, I probably shouldn't say this, especially in Scotland, but Billy Connolly once said to me, oh, the first... I can't do his accent. But he said to me that when he first got married to Pamela Stevenson and then did a gig and then realised he couldn't sleep with someone after gig, it was really like a shock to him. Mm. Like, that was the thing that he did after gigs, and I think he described it as his special treat. And he couldn't do it anymore. And actually, you know, I mean, I don't wish to bring this podcast down because it's a lot of quite interesting intellectual stuff we've talked about, as well as your fetishes. But it is definitely a reason why something goes out of stand-up comedy.
Sure.
I think I've lost the audience saying
I just wanted you to click. It's definitely why something goes.
Well, it's a very simple thing. I'm saying the same reason that people in the 60s talked about wanting to be in bands, blah, blah, blah. It is a good reason, certainly for a man, to do stand-up comedy because it will make you more attractive to women. If you're funny and you're on stage getting a laugh, you definitely improve your attractiveness level to women. And then if you've got kids and you're with someone properly and you can't action that, it's a pain in the ass. So that's probably why I won't be. But I will be. What I'm planning to do with this show... I'm so bad at planning anything, but I think the idea is that I will... I'm doing it in London. I'm doing one night at the RSC, which is kind of gratifying, actually, because I think someone from the RSC just saw it and thought, oh, there's something theatrical about this. There's something, you know, it's more like a show than just David Baddiel talking, and so it'll suit that space. I'm doing one night there on October 27th, and then 4 nights, I think, at the Purcell Rooms in November. And then I think I might... tour it a little bit, like not a proper tour, but just do kind of one night in Manchester, and then whatever, one night in Sheffield, whatever the big towns. And then what I'm hoping to do maybe is a West End run. I'll just have to see how it goes.
And can you see yourself doing other lecture-based shows or other lectures? The pre-show lecture that you did, would you do that on other subjects?
I think I'd use a screen always because I like using the screen. Mm-hmm. I think a screen just mixes it up, and it does do a thing for me of providing evidence, which is sort of what I meant by that Madonna bit before we got lost in the Danny Wallace bit. My point about was that I like that it helps the truth, mm-hmm. that people who are anyone in the audience who might be thinking he never met Madonna, it's bollocks, can then see me meeting Madonna, you know, and actually can see me standing by while she's obviously talking to Ricky Gervais. But I am thinking about putting a show together about my mother, who is really, really an eccentric and unusual Mintler, and I'm thinking about doing that as another show. So I have thought about maybe continuing this idea of doing kind of concept shows or whatever. Yeah.
I think that's all we've got time for, I'm afraid. We could probably squeeze in one more question if there is one, and if there isn't, then that'll do us. Thank you very much, David Baddiel, for coming to talk to us, ladies and gentlemen.
Thank you. Thank you.
So that was David. Thank you very much to him for coming along. I suppose I was a little bit starstruck at the beginning there. David's one of those people whose work I can still probably quote from when I was a teenager. So very kind of him to come on and do the show and be so forthcoming. Thanks to all the usual suspects. Obviously, Dan Melrose for the music, Graham Crockford for technical support, which I'm pleased to say I'm mostly doing myself these days, but he's always there at the end of an email if I need him. And I say this now, having not quite yet removed a little bit of a line buzz on this recording. So assuming that this one went well, great. If it went well, then thanks to Graham, probably that's normally how it works. So that's all of that. Yes, I mentioned a couple of plugs. Obviously, David Baddiel's show, Fame Not the Musical, is now on tour, I hear, from late January, early February next year. You can get all the details from that by following him at Baddiel or going to his website. And you can follow me at ComComPod. So do get in touch if you like. And there are some tickets available still for myself and James Acaster, each doing an hour of new stuff at the Pleasance in London in Caledonian Road on Wednesday, the 18th of December. Get some tickets for those from the Pleasance website. Put it into Googles and Google that up. And also, this is far in advance, I know, but the Leicester Comedy Festival brochure is coming out very soon. We've just recently proofed that. On the 16th of February next year, at the Leicester Comedy Festival, I'll be doing a live ComCom pod interviewing the brilliant Jared Christmas, and I'll also be doing my by then much more ready work in progress solo show. There's another great live ComCom pod coming up soon next year with one of my most requested guests. I'm very excited about this. I'll give you a clue. It's not Daniel Kitson. I know that's not really a clue. It just isn't. It's someone else quite different and very excellent indeed. So stay tuned. Keep listening to find out more stuff. Feel free to donate if you would like. If you wouldn't, then do please tell people about the show. That's almost as good as a donation. Thanks very much for listening. I'll speak to you next week with, I'll say it, I'm fairly sure this is the order, Susan Kalman. It's such a good show. I'm so excited about it. I'll get that one to you as soon as I can. So look forward to that. I've been Stuart Goldsmith. I'll speak to you very soon.